Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia, Miguel Martinez. Thank you, Miguel. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Today we're just going to talk about the risk of anesthesia and how to minimize anesthetic morbidity and mortality. Well, morbidity, if you're unfamiliar with the term, means complications during anesthesia. This lecture is based on the most up-to-date study in mortality and morbidity in small animals, which is done by David Brodbold in 2008. That seems like quite some time. However, there hasn't been any more large-scale recent studies. For the first part of the lecture, I'm going to try to discuss in some detail the results obtained in this study. And then after that, based on all this very useful information, we will try to discuss some changes or measures that we can put into practice in order to decrease the number of casualties while we are doing anesthesia. Right, I'm just going to go ahead with the first few slides then. So what is the risk of anesthesia? Well, this risk is quite variable depending on very many factors, as we're going to see in a few slides. One of the first things to say is that we are actually dealing with several different species in small animal practice, and that will definitely have an effect on the risk of anesthesia. This is the study in which we are going to base this lecture. The title is The Risk of Death, Confidential Inquiry into Perioperative Small Animal Fatalities, SEPSAF. And that was published in the Veterinary Anesthesia and Analgesia Journal in 2008. The main author is David Brodbold, but this was a multi-center study where tens of veterinary practices and hospitals of different types were involved by providing cases to the researchers. So this is the first page title of this study, and one of the main things I'd like to mention is that it is a large-scale study which allows the statistics to be very, very potent and provide reliable results, if you like, or meaningful results. They used around 100,000 anesthetics in dogs, around 80,000 anesthetics in cats, and around 10,000 anesthetics in rabbits, and then many other cases of other small animal species like birds, reptiles, and the likes. So what are the main figures? What is the mortality risk? And like I said before, there is a huge difference depending on the species. So as you can see here from David Brodbold's study, we learned that the anesthetic the mortality risk in dogs is about 0.17%, which is approximately one dog in 600 that is anesthetized will die for very many different reasons. And this is regardless of the severity of the condition or whether it is healthy or not. In cats, the risk is fairly similar. It's 0.24%, it's one in 400, so it's not too bad. And then we have a huge variation in risk. So ferrets are not too bad and similar to dogs, and cats 0.33%. But then in rabbits, it's 1.39%. So one in 72 rabbits will die under anesthesia, which shows how difficult and risky is to perform any procedures under anesthesia in this particular species. And what it suggests really is that there is a lot of room for improvement. Horses, which is obviously not a small animal, the risk is about 1%, 0.9%, which is also much higher, and there are many factors related to the temperament of horses and also their size principally. And then, as you can see, the risk in humans is so much lower. Some studies in humans suggest that only one in 100,000 human beings being anesthetized will die under general anesthesia, really, which is a very, very low risk. And this would be probably our reference for the future. We need to look at what they do in human beings and why their mortality risk is so much lower, why anesthetics are so safe. As you can see in some other species like guinea pigs, especially like the small rodents, guinea pigs, rats, rabbits, as I mentioned before, the mortality rate is so much higher, between 2 and 4%, and in birds it can go up to 16%, really, which is a lot, really. More than 1 in 10 will die under anesthesia. So if we go into a little bit more detail to analyze this raw data, we can see when the complications and the problems happen during the anesthetic, in what period. Looking here on the left-hand side of the screen, see if I can put the arrow. So we can see here on the left-hand side, there are three different species analyzed, dogs, cats, and rabbits, and percentage will be within brackets. So during after premedication, there is a very small number of deaths, really. Induction of anesthesia is a relatively safe part of the anesthetic. So just under 10% of dogs will die, cats and rabbits will die under, during the induction phase. Maintenance is the longer lasting phase. So you will have a mortality that varies between say approximately 50% and 30% depending on the species. And then bear in mind that obviously the maintenance phase is quite long. And then, which is the probably the most important part of this table here, you can see how the vast majority of anesthetic deaths occur during the perioperative period, up to 50% approximately in dogs, and then almost two-thirds in cats and rabbits. And looking at the raw figures in terms of how soon or late during the post-operative period, the vast majority of them die during the first 3 hours, so really in the early recovery phase. So this shows that, and we will look at it and discuss this later, that during this time, during the early recovery, is when we actually have to pay more attention to the patients. And we will see or try to analyze why more deaths happen during this period of time. If we actually go to the next table, table 6 on the right-hand side of the screen, you can also see in more detail what was the cause of death according to the anesthetists at the time. So for dogs, cats and rabbits, again, in parentheses you have the percentage, and you can see that cardiovascular causes were up to 23% in dogs, and in cats and rabbits was a low percentage, 6 and 3% respectively, while respiratory causes were a little bit higher, approximately 10% for all three species. And then either cardiovascular or respiratory, so a mix of them, was the vast majority of them. A few other cases, not many, had as a cause of death a neurological cause, approximately 5% in dogs and cats and 2% in rabbits, and renal causes in a few cases too. And then, which is quite remarkable, the cause of death is unknown or reported as unknown in up to 20% of dogs, 20% of cats, and more importantly, 60% of rabbits. So if we put together these two tables on the left as what phase of recovery, and on the right, what was the cause of death, you could probably say that lots of our patients, particularly rabbits and cats, but also dogs, die during the early recovery phase. And in very many cases, we don't know why they die, which maybe could suggest that the amount of monitoring and the amount of care for those patients in this phase is actually suboptimal, let's say. So many of these patients are likely to be unattended when the actual complication happens, and because of that they die without having an appropriate care. So this is an area where we should be much more careful and perhaps try to improve our standard of care there. So going to the analysis of the risk factors in different species in a little bit more detail, we have here a slide where we discuss the risk factors for anesthetic death in dogs. First of all, the ASA status. The ASA status is the health status of the patient using the American Society of Anesthesiology classification, which classifies dogs in 5 different levels of depending on the health status. So 1 would be absolutely healthy, and 5 would be a moribund animal. So the ASA status is directly related to the risk of an anesthetic death. And when you go on the scale from 1 or 2, ASA 1 or 2 to 1, ASA 3 or 4, there is actually a 6 times a higher risk of death in these patients. So ASA 3 and 4 patients will have 6 times more chances to die under anesthesia than ASA 1 and 2, which is probably a logical thing to think, because basically less healthy animals are more risky patients for anesthesia. With regards to emergency anesthetics or out-of-hours cases, there is a 3 times higher risk of death for these cases. When we talk about the type of procedure, major procedures like trauma surgery, brain surgery, complicated abdominal surgery will have a 5-fold increase in the risk of death under anesthesia. And then geriatric dogs older than 12 years of age will have 7 times more chances to die under GA. Finally, and this is quite important also, little dogs have up to 8 times higher risk of anesthetic death. And the explanations for this would be the difficulty to have access to the patient while being operated, the reliability of anesthetic equipment in such small patients, maybe the possibility of overdosing accidentally as being so small, and maybe also heat loss as a main factor, since smaller size animals lose heat more rapidly than larger animals. If we go to the next slide, we will discuss the risk factors in cats. So cats in general have a slightly higher risk of anesthetic death than dogs. And again, coincidental with dogs, the ASA status, the emergency anesthetic, major procedures, and geriatric patients, and also the extremes of weight. Both cats smaller than 2 kilos of body weight or cats larger than 6 kilos of body weight will increase the risk of death. It is particularly important the increased risk in cats smaller than 2 kilos of body weight, where it is, I think, by memory I'm quoting, is about 16 times higher really than normal sized cats. Importantly also, and different to dogs, the study showed that endotracheal intubation and fluid therapy could have a small increase in the risk of death under anesthesia, which is counterintuitive, because you could expect that a patient with a protected airway with an ET tube is less likely to die. And also fluid therapy is thought to be a better standard of care than no fluid therapy. However, perhaps in cats, because of their small size, inadvertent over-administration of fluids could potentially cause more problems. And also endotracheal intubation, due to the sensitivity of the larynx to manipulations, and also the relatively common complication of tracheal necrosis, perhaps that would increase the risk of death in some cases. However, I think this is something that needs to be confirmed with further studies, perhaps in the future. And I would still recommend in most cases to intubate cats with good technique, and also to give adequate fluid therapy during the anesthetics and before and after, as required after assessment of the hydration status. Going on to the next slide, that discusses the risk factors as a table, really. So here I would like to show you perhaps how, when we look at the odds ratio, which is basically the chances of death compared to normal risk, you can see how here cats weighing less than 2 kilos of body weight have a risk, as I said, of approximately 16 times higher of death. And then you can see how endotracheal intubation is about twice as risky than no endotracheal intubation. And IV fluids is about 4 times higher risk of death. Another thing that you can see here that I didn't discuss before is that if you actually monitor pulse or pulse and pulse oximetry, the risk of death is reduced to 1/3 or 1/5 of the standard risk. So it is actually very important and absolutely essential to have an operator monitoring the patient at all times, and also to use monitoring equipment such as pulse oximetry, which is very inexpensive, but also more advanced equipment if it is available. On the next slide, we discuss the anesthetic risk factors in rabbits. The power of the study with about 8,000 rabbits was still not enough to obtain meaningful figures really for risk factors. However, from experience, it has been discussed that the reasons for rabbits to have such a high risk of death, up to 1.4% of them, so 1 in 70 rabbits, is probably because of their small size, and together with that comes the risk of overdosing and heat loss and equipment not working very well. Also, the very potent stress response, which is activated with just human handling or being in a strange environment like it could be a veterinary hospital, and also the presence of subclinical respiratory disease such as pasteurilosis that is often undetected on clinical exam. Also, perhaps the lack of familiarity with these species in terms of anesthetic techniques. For instance, and as we can see in the photograph, endotracheal intubation due to their different anatomy can be fairly complicated to do unless you have a specific training and experience. So obviously the lack of protected airway and delivery of oxygen into the lungs could definitely affect the anesthetic risk. And also the lack of specific training in terms of what are the normal physiological variables in this patient and what type of equipment works better. For instance, some pulse oximeters will not actually read properly with heart rates above 300, which are fairly common in rabbits under anesthesia. And also the difficulty to place an intravenous catheter. So all these little things will add up to make anesthetics in rabbits more risky. And from here we can learn that by taking them into consideration and improving our handling and techniques in rabbit anesthesia, we can probably achieve better results and reduce their mortality. The next slide will kind of deal with morbidity or complications under anesthesia. So not only we worry about survival as a unique outcome in anesthesia, but also about possible complications that could happen during and after the anesthetic and then leave our pets with important problems to deal with after. Amongst the most common complications related to general anesthesia in dogs, cats and rabbits are renal failure, post-anesthetic blindness, neurological deficits such as coma or cranial nerve deficits or difficulties with ambulation, aspiration pneumonia, and as a consequence of that, pneumonia, pneumonitis, and respiratory complications, airway damage such as laryngeal edema or tracheal stenosis as a result of or tracheal rupture as a result of tracheal necrosis, and also in some cases myocardial damage due to myocardial hypoxia and cardiovascular complications. So, once we have discussed the figures in terms of mortality and complications and the reasons for these figures and the reasons behind that, then we will have to implement a plan of action to try and improve our standard anesthesia and reduce the number of complications and the number of anesthetic deaths. We could think that this could be fairly complicated and expensive. Straight away we could think, well, we are going to need advanced monitoring and so on and so forth. But however, looking at the results of the confidential inquiry into small animal perioperative fatalities, we can see that only by doing a few very simple changes and often quite inexpensive, we could potentially reduce the risk of death greatly in our own practice, really. So I'm going to try to explain what these actions would be. And finally, at the end of the lecture, we will also have a look at a couple of cases with some analysis of the risk factors in those specific cases. So what is the first thing you could do to reduce the number of complications and the anesthetic deaths? Well, the first thing would be to have an anesthetist. Nowadays, all the different disciplines are specializing very quickly, and there are lots of advancements, and our clients are more and more demanding in terms of the standard of care they expect of us. So one of the things we can do, particularly in larger practices where there is several vets, is to actually have a specialized vet that will be in charge of the anesthesia department and perhaps have a further qualification. You can have qualifications such as the diploma, the European diploma in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia, or perhaps like a GP certificate. And this person would be in charge of the anesthesia department and make decisions in terms of what techniques and protocols we are going to use, what sort of equipment we are going to need, and how to perform the anesthetics safely. And also, anesthetists are very often very well trained to do lots of things. So not only we will deal with anesthetics, but also very often we can be very helpful in terms of monitoring of any patient in the hospital, and areas like fluid therapy, nutrition, and the likes, as well as analgesia, of course. Also, it is very important to have well-trained nurses for that, and anesthetist would be also a person that could be extremely helpful in implementing regular training sessions and improving the different techniques that the nurses can then carry out. More importantly than anything, it needs to be stressed that it is very important that during any anesthetic procedure, there is one person absolutely focused on monitoring the patient and dealing with the patient from the anesthesia point of view, while somebody else will do the rest of the procedures. As shown before in the statistics, this will greatly reduce the risk of death as little as only 20% of the average death if there is no person monitoring specifically the anesthetic. So that is very important. Either a vet or a nurse has to be in charge of monitoring the patient while it is anesthetized, and also during the recovery phase. The other thing we can do, and it has been discussed and investigated in several different research studies, is preoperative screening. So the question will be, do we do a blood test for every single patient before an anesthetic? Is this reasonable, or what are the pros and cons? So from a financial point of view, yes, it is probably a good thing to do pre-anesthetic bloods for every single patient. However, from a clinical point of view, this is not always absolutely necessary. There was a study published also in 2008 by Michel Aleph and performed in the University of Leipzig in Germany, where they had a look at the impact of pre-anesthetic blood screening in the anesthetic techniques to be performed in the anesthetic complications and deaths. And the conclusion of it was that in the vast majority of cases, particularly with healthy animals that have gone through a pre-anesthetic questionnaire and a full physical exam, the findings of this questionnaire and physical exam were enough to have a good idea of what was the health status of the patient, and only in very few cases the blood test results will actually change something in the anesthetic protocol, or even cancel or postpone the procedure until further tests and treatments were done, really. So the advice from this study would be that it is probably helpful to do pre-anesthetic bloods. It's not absolutely necessary, particularly when a proper physical exam and a pre-anesthetic questionnaire has done, and the animal seems to be healthy based on those questionnaires and physical exam. And once we do that, if we detect any problems, perhaps we could do some more specific tests based on the findings of the physical exam and the questionnaire. This is the front page of this study by Michelle Aleph. What other things can we do to improve our standard of anesthetics in the practice? Another thing that I would definitely recommend is to follow an anesthetic record. The anesthetic record will definitely have a lot of important data that we can use to analyze what's going on during the anesthetic. One of the things is that it will allow us to classify our patients according to the American Society of Anesthesiologists classification, and that will give us an idea of what the risk of the anesthetic can be. Also, all the relevant data will be in a single piece of paper, so we will have the signalment of the patient, the drugs administered, the cardiovascular and respiratory variables recorded every 5 or 10 minutes at least, and the trends during the anesthetic. So if any changes occur, we can actually quickly spot the trends and the problems in the anesthetic record, and then hopefully take the required measures to prevent any complications or problems during the anesthetic. Also, a complete anesthetic record means that there is actually somebody actively collecting all this data and monitoring the patient. So the fact that we have an anesthetic record reflects on the fact that we will actually have an anesthetist or a person monitoring the anesthetic, which, as we know, is like a protective factor for the risk of anesthetic death. What about anesthetic equipment? So with regards to anesthetic equipment, it is very important that we always prepare and check all the equipment before we start the anesthetic. That includes the anesthetic machine and all the monitoring equipment that we are going to use. Make sure that you have all your drugs prepared and labeled, all the doses pre-calculated, all the equipment for airway maintenance like ET tubes, laryngoscope, ties, everything ready. Oxygen supply, it is a must. And check that there is enough oxygen for the procedure that we are required, and make sure that all the equipment to deliver oxygen and anesthetics is ready and in good working order. Besides, it is important to say that if we have a lot of monitoring equipment, it is obviously always a bonus, but it is very important to have actually somebody to look at that equipment and to be able to interpret with what the equipment is telling you. There is very little point in having expensive equipment if we don't know how to analyze and act upon the information that it's given by the monitoring equipment. For instance, you can have the most expensive multi-parameter monitor with blood pressure, ECG, capnography, and so on and so forth, but if you don't know what to do with that data, it is we will have an anesthetic record showing us problems, but we will not actually have a plan of action after. So it's very important that the personnel attending the anesthetic is well trained and it's able to interpret all the data obtained from the equipment. One thing I would like to stress is that it is probably nowadays not acceptable to do anesthetics in practice without using any sort of electronic equipment. Equipment such as a pulse oximeter, it is absolutely inexpensive nowadays. Recently, I have been able to acquire some pulse oximeters for as little as £10 online. So it is definitely no excuse to say, well, that it is too expensive. And there has to be a minimum of anesthetic or monitoring equipment when we perform anesthesia in our practice. So what is the best monitor we can actually have? Well, it obviously depends on the finances, the availability of financial muscle to buy equipment. The recommended equipment to use for anesthetics would be at least a pulse oximeter, ideally capnography, some means of measuring blood pressure, and there are three different types of blood pressure monitors. You can have Doppler, or you can have an oscillometric method. The Doppler method provides a measurement of the systolic blood pressure, while the oscillometric and the direct blood pressure methods will provide systolic, diastolic, and mean blood pressure. And the direct method is obviously the gold standard, the most accurate one, and it will consist of a catheter inserted in a peripheral artery, and then a transducer that measures the blood pressure directly from it, bit by bit, actually. And finally, very important to monitor the temperature of the patient before, during, and after the anesthetic. So you can see here a few examples of monitors. Here you have an old second-hand multi-parameter monitor that you can buy online in some of these auction medical equipment places. Then you can have a more advanced multi-parameter monitor, and the prices will go probably from somewhere between 3,000 and 8,000 pounds. And then you can have some much more basic equipment and very inexpensive, like a pulse oximeter. There are very different, many different qualities, but like I say, the prices start from as little as £10 up to maybe 200 or 300 pounds for better quality ones. And also you have like all bits of equipment here to measure blood pressure, capnography, and the likes. So with small or large budgets, you can actually do quite a lot. If we go one by one, with regards to pulse oximetry, I think that would be the most basic equipment that we could have for monitoring anesthetics, together or alongside, like we can see in this picture, with just a standard thermometer, digital thermometer. So the pulse oximeter will give you an indication of the pulse rate and the SpO2, which is the saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen in arterial circulation. It is a very useful piece of equipment, fairly simple to interpret. So it is probably the, I would say, mandatory to have it in your practice. And like I said before, prices start from as little as £10, so there is really no excuse not to have one. Another piece of equipment that I would definitely recommend would be capnography. Here on the screen, you can see a monitor that shows an ECG, but also capnography. Here, you can see the capnogram is this trace line here, which measures the expired concentration of or pressure of CO2 in the airway. And in this case, that's the end-tidal CO2, which is the number read at the end of expiration. It is very high in this case, up to 71. Capnography is an extremely useful piece of equipment. It can be helpful not only to measure respiratory rate and the end-tidal CO2, which are like variables related to respiratory function, but it also tells you a lot of, or can potentially be telling you a lot about cardiovascular function, and also about the function of the anesthetic equipment, such as airway obstructions, intubation in the esophagus, also disconnection of the breathing system from the patient, or malfunction of the valves of the anesthetic equipment. So all of them are extremely useful. It is known from very many different studies that capnography plus pulse oximetry can detect up to a 90% of the potential anesthetic complications. So it is actually highly recommended to have capnography and pulse oximetry together to monitor all the anesthetics. Capnography requires a fair bit more knowledge to interpret all the the different types of capnograms and all the data. And for that, it is very useful to go to websites such as www.capnography.com, which is a free website where capnography is explained from the very basic to the most advanced detail, really. So I highly recommend to have a capnographer in your practice to monitor all the anesthetics of all the patients that are intubated, really. And together with pulse oximetry, that will be extremely helpful, definitely. The prices of capnographers are much higher, and probably the cheapest are starting probably around £1,500 to £2,000. However, it is really worth buying them, and they are usually very durable. So once you buy it, you will use it so many times that it is worth buying one. Temperature is extremely important. Very cheap to measure temperature with just a simple electronic thermometer. You can measure the rectal temperature. There is also temperature probes that you can put in the esophagus or rectally, and they measure the temperature constantly during the whole duration of the anesthetic. It is a very useful variable to measure, and it is definitely important to know whether there is hypothermia. And I would like to remind you that temperature loss starts from the very moment of pre-medication and not just while you're anesthetized. So managing the temperature and avoiding temperature loss is something that we need to be very proactive with from the very beginning of the anesthetic. Like I said, it's actually very inexpensive, so it shouldn't be a problem. Every single dog anesthetized must have his temperature taken before the anesthetic, at least once during the anesthetic, and definitely at the very end. And we all know that hypothermia is behind many anesthetic and post-anesthetic complications. So what about blood pressure? And here you have several different pictures. On this, the first one on the left side, you can see an arterial line placed, or an arterial catheter placed in the dorsopedial artery of a cat. Here you can see on the right-hand side, the pulse wave obtained through an arterial line through direct blood pressure measurement with the systolic, diastolic, and mean blood pressure. And here you have a multi-parameter monitor measuring blood pressure by means of an oscillometric method. And here you have a colleague measuring Doppler blood pressure in a rabbit during an operation. So blood pressure is a very useful variable to measure by different means. The one thing it is very important to remember is that the measurement of blood pressure is unfortunately often riddled with different artifacts and inaccurate readings. So we need to be able to interpret the quality of the reading and put that together with the clinical signs to see if what the numbers we obtain from the machine do actually make sense. However, once we are happy that the quality of the reading is good, it is actually extremely useful, and it is always recommended that the mean blood pressure during anesthesia does not go below 60 millimeters of mercury, and ideally it is kept at least about 70 millimeters of mercury to maintain a good flow through the main organs such as the brain, the heart, and the kidney. So how can we improve our post-op monitoring? Well, this is a very important thing to do. And like I said before, from the analysis of the statistics, we know that up to 50 or 60% of our patients die during the post-operative period, which in my opinion does suggest that there is a lack of monitoring at that point. And this is the area where we could more easily actually achieve better results and improvements in our incidence of complications and mortality. So one of the things I would suggest to do is to actually monitor SpO2. By doing so, we make sure that the patient is actually taking enough oxygen in the recovery period, while the X-ray, the airway is not protected anymore, and we will probably not be supplemented with oxygen. If the SpO2 drops, We will, as a first measure, we will have to make sure that the airway is patent, and secondly, maybe provide supplemental oxygen by means of flow by oxygen or a mask or nasal prongs or the likes. We can also, or we should also check the temperature. And like I said before, hypothermia is very often behind many of the cases of complications during recovery. Hypothermia will reduce cardiovascular performance. It will also delay recovery and delay metabolism of drugs. So we will definitely need to check the temperature. If the temperature is low, we will have to actively warm up the patient. And also have adequate facilities and staff. It is very important to have a recovery area in the practice that is well staffed, and we need to make sure that there is somebody monitoring, somebody watching the patient, particularly during the early phases of recovery, those first few minutes where we go from having the patient monitored, intubated with oxygen provided and many other vital parts of the physiology supported, to actually having it in a kennel where perhaps there is a lot less vigilance. There's definitely not an airway, a protected airway. There's no oxygen supply possibly, and the monitoring is a lot less invasive, if you like. So it is very important to have somebody there checking that everything is okay and the patient has a smooth and rapid, ideally, recovery. So how do we prevent hypothermia? Well, like I said before, hypothermia is behind many cases of complications and mortality. And again, I would like to insist that heat loss starts at premedication. So we need to protect our patients from heat loss through insulation and having a warm environment from the very moment of premedication. Patients can be insulated with things like bubble wrap or avoiding definitely cold metal surfaces and the likes. And also, if available, we can use active warming devices such as this one here, which is called Bear Hugger, that can be bought either new or second hand from several different websites. Importantly, we have to monitor temperature. Of course, if we don't measure the temperature, we don't know if the patient is hypothermic, so this is the first requirement. So what about fluid therapy? In cats, it could potentially contribute to mortality. However, that doesn't mean that we have not to use fluid therapy. I would still recommend using fluid therapy in all those cases where it is considered important. In patients that are well hydrated and estimated to be normovolemic from the clinical history, physical exam, and maybe some blood results, if the procedure is not likely to be long, and there's no blood loss involved or like fluid loss involved, then it is possible to do anesthetics without fluid therapy or just using maintenance fluid therapy at a rate of between 2 and 4 milliliters per kilo and per hour of crystalloids. However, we know that an excessive fluid intake, so higher rates when they're not required, could increase morbidity and mortality through like causing peripheral edema and decreased oxygen delivery to peripheral tissues. Very important, of course, for good recovery and also in terms of welfare is to provide good analgesia. There are very many different techniques, huge advances in the last few years in local regional anesthesia, nerve blocks, wound catheters, epidural catheters, and so many different options, some of them really very inexpensive and with the correct training and equipment, very easy to perform. Good analgesia will improve the welfare of our patients. It provides job satisfaction to the anesthetist or the people involved in the care of the patient. It definitely speeds up recovery and it reduces morbidity and mortality based on data obtained from human beings. Another one important thing to do, during the anesthetic, but also in the recovery phase, it is important to have oxygen available. We will provide oxygen always in case of doubt. So if we are measuring SpO2 or if we think that our patient is breathing too slowly or there is an airway obstruction or something, we have to unblock the airway and always provide supplemental oxygen. In case of doubt, it will never do any harm, so just provide oxygen. Definitely always use general anesthetic. And also, and don't forget that when patients are deeply sedated, like with combinations with alpha 2 agonists like methotrexate and opioids, these patients who are really very deeply sedated and nearly anesthetized sometimes, they do benefit from having oxygen supplementation. And I do highly recommend also SpO2 monitoring in all these patients. So this would be like a general discussion of anesthetic risk and measures that we can implement in our practice to improve our outcomes. However, I'd like to have a look at two specific cases where we can just look at different risk factors and then analyze how we would approach them, if you like. The first case is a 19-year-old cat. His body weight is 3.1 kilograms of body weight. The cat has severe periodontal disease, is anorexic. It is also been diagnosed with hyperthyroidism. Blood results suggest mild azotemia, so increased urea and creatinine. And the cat comes to our surgery to have dental treatment, including extractions. So dental scale and polys plus extractions. So how would you approach the anesthesia of such a patient, which is a very, very common case probably in general practice? So what are the anesthetic considerations? So looking at all the things we discussed before, I would say that this cat is a small size, 3.1 kilograms, which could potentially increase the risk of anesthetic complications or death. By being small and skinny, he might just be at risk of developing fairly quickly hypothermia. And also, we need to dose all the drugs accurately and make sure that the equipment works properly in this patient. Another factor to consider is that the cat is 19 years old, and we know from David Brockwell's study that that will increase the risk of death several times. The other thing is pain. We know from the lecture that good analgesia will speed up recovery, reduce complications, and in general reduce morbidity and mortality. So having had dental extractions and also periodontal inflammation, pain needs to be managed appropriately during the surgery and after. Another factor would be dehydration. The cat has not been eating properly, so we could expect from the appearance and proper physical exam and from the clinical history that there might be some degree of dehydration, which together with the results of urea and creatinine suggest that this patient would benefit from some preparation before the anesthetic and some fluid therapy. I wouldn't do this very quickly. I would just do it over a period of maybe 24 hours. The cat has poor body condition and a catabolic state, probably due to kidney disease and hyperthyroidism, which is a factor to bear in mind. Renal function, as I mentioned before. The aim here will be to protect the kidney from further injury during the anesthetic, so it is very important that the cat receives fluid therapy and has an adequate volume, circulating volume, and we maintain blood pressure during the anesthetic at normal or slightly higher than normal levels, somewhere mean blood pressure is somewhere around 70 or 80 millimeters of mercury at least. If the cat was hypertensive before surgery, which we could check by means of Doppler blood pressure measurement, then we have to consider to try and maintain a slightly higher than normal blood pressure or a very high blood pressure during the anesthetic to protect the kidney's circulation and blood flow. Because the cat is hyperthyroid, he will be probably very sensitive to stress and increasing myocardial oxygen consumption. If there is myocardial hypoxia, he would be at risk of arrhythmias and sudden death. So a stress-free environment, good pre-medication, and good handling are very important in cases like this. And of course, heat loss. During the dental, they might just get wet. We need to be careful not to put them on cold surfaces, and so maybe wrap them up with several layers of bubble wrap, towels, anything, and maybe some active warming by means of bear hugger, or if you have like an electric blanket or something like that. But very, very careful always with this equipment, because they can cause skin burns. Okay, so never in direct contact to the skin of the cat. So that was for the old cat with dental problems. Our last case, and with this we will close this lecture, is a 3-year-old English bulldog that comes to our surgery as an emergency with dyspnea, stridor suggesting an upper airway obstruction, and the dog is actually overweight. He is very nervous and snappy, so it's difficult to handle. And we know from a quick physical exam that he's got a high temperature, he's hypothermic. So what are the risk factors in this case? What are the anesthetic considerations? First of all, these dogs are in immediate risk of death because of upper airway obstruction and hypothermia. They can just develop severe hypoxia and die. So they need to be dealt with very, very quickly and following a quick pattern. I would definitely advise, if you know from a previous phone call that the dog is a dog in this condition is coming to the surgery, to prepare all the equipment in advance so everybody knows what to do and where are the things you're going to need. So the patient is difficult to handle, so that will be increased stress, IV access and everything else. So one suggestion would be to provide some sort of sedation for the patient that doesn't actually affect the respiratory system too much. For that, maybe a dose of azithromycin is probably the most recommended nowadays. And that includes the minimizing stress. So we do a very quick physical exam, try to provide oxygen, and put an IV catheter and sedate the patient at the same time. Everything with as little handling as possible and in a quiet and cool environment. So we provide oxygen as pre-oxygenation or oxygenation. Nasal prongs or oxygen chambers are useful in these cases. If they don't tolerate either, then the best thing is just to try oxygen flow by perhaps without bothering the dog too much. So once we have all the equipment ready and IV access, this dog needs control of the airway, and for that he will need an injection of a rapidly acting induction agent. And then from there, we will intubate the patient and provide 100% oxygen and control breathing so much better. And the other problem will be that once we have done all that, and everything is under control, and then we cool down the patient, and if he needs any surgical treatment, it is done, then we need to recover this patient. So there is the an obvious risk of airway obstruction during the recovery phase. So it is important to cool down the patient, provide adequate analgesia, perhaps sometimes very, very mild sedation, but very important, get everything prepared, have oxygen supply, sometimes just put some nasal prongs or catheter in the dog for the recovery phase, so we can support it and have an intubation kit ready in case a severe complication happens. And like I said, you know, manage temperature and reduce the hypothermia or control the hypothermia. So with this, we just finished the lecture. If there are any questions, I would be happy to take them. And I would just like to thank you for listening to this lecture. And there at the bottom of the slide, you have my email in case you'd like to, you know, you have any questions that I can answer. So thank you very much, and I'll pass the microphone back.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Miguel for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.